Jia Hutch. God unto you, my friends.
This is Reverse Deception Radio, the Veritas Radio Network, Crusade Channel.
This Misha, Greg Carpenter.
King-sized truth from radio-sized speakers.
If you have the luck of the Irish, you'd be sorry and wish you were dead. You should have the luck of the Irish, and you'd wish you was English instead. A thousand years of torture and hunger drove the people away from their land. A land full of beauty and wonder was raped by the British brigands. Goddamn.
If you could keep vices like flowers, there'd be shamrock all over the world. If you could drink dreams like Irish dreams, the world would be higher, the mountain of more.
In the pool they told us a story, how the English divided the land, of the pain, the death, and the glory, and the poets of old Ireland.
If we could make change with the morning dew, the world would be like Galway Bay. Let's walk over rainbows like leprechauns. The world would be one big blind stone.
Why the hell are the English there anyways, as they kill with God on their side? Blame it all on the kids and the IRA, as the bastards commit genocide. All right, genocide.
If you had the luck of the Irish, you'd be sorry and wish you were dead. You should have the luck of the Irish, and you'd wish you was English instead. Yes, you'd wish you was English instead.
Enough is enough. The proclamation of the Republic, also known as the 1916 Proclamation, or more accurately, the Easter Proclamation.
The proclamation of Poblach na hÉireann, the provisional government of the Irish Republic, to the people of Ireland. Irish men and Irish women, in the name of God and of the dead generations from which she receives her old tradition of nationhood, Ireland through us summons her children to her flag and strikes for her freedom. Having organised and trained her manhood through her secret revolutionary organisation, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and through her open military organisations, the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizen Army, having patiently perfected her discipline, having resolutely waited for the right moment to reveal itself, she now seizes that moment. And supported by her exiled children in America and by gallant allies in Europe, but relying in the first on her own strength, she strikes in full confidence of victory. We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destinies to be sovereign and indefeasible. The long usurpation of that right by a foreign people and government has not extinguished the right, nor can it ever be extinguished, except by the destruction of the Irish people. In every generation, the Irish people have asserted their right to national freedom and sovereignty. Six times during the past 300 years, they have asserted it in arms. Standing on that fundamental right, and again asserting it in arms, in the face of the world, we hereby proclaim the Irish Republic as a sovereign, independent state. And we pledge our lives and the lives of our comrades in arms to the cause of its freedom, of its welfare and of its exaltation among the nations. The Irish Republic is entitled to and hereby claims the allegiance of every Irish man and Irish woman. The Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunity to all its citizens, and declares its resolve to pursue the happiness and prosperity of the whole nation and of all its parts, cherishing all the children of the nation equally and oblivious of the differences carefully fostered by an alien government, which have divided a minority from the majority in the past. Until our arms have brought the opportune moment for the establishment of a permanent national government, representative of the whole people of Ireland, and elected by the suffrages of all her men and women, the provisional government hereby constituted will administer the civil and military affairs of the Republic in trust for the people. We place the cause of the Irish Republic under the protection of the Most High God, whose blessing we invoke upon our arms. And we pray that no one who serves that cause will dishonour it by cowardice, inhumanity or rapine. In the supreme hour, the Irish nation must, by its valour and discipline, and by the readiness of its children to sacrifice themselves for the common good, prove itself worthy of the august destiny to which it is called. Signed on behalf of the Provisional Government, Thomas J. Clarke, Sean McDermott, P.H. Pierce, James Connolly, Thomas McDonough, Eamon Kent, Joseph Plunkett.
Ireland possessed its own distinctive culture, language, religion, and people prior to England's repeated invasions. During the 16th and 17th centuries, England not only conquered Ireland by military force, but under my first cousin, 11 times removed, Oliver Cromwell, and his forces killed tens of thousands of Irish, Catholic Irish, and drove hundreds of thousands more off their lands in northeastern Ireland, the Ulster section. These Irish Catholics were then forcibly relocated to rocky, desolate areas in the west of Ireland, Connaught, where the land was suitable only for potato crop. The land taken from the Irish Catholics in Ulster was offered to Protestants from Scotland and England to entice them to relocate to Ireland. This British policy created a sizable group of Protestant settlers in Northern Ireland loyal to the British government. And in 1695, England enacted a series of penal laws that denied civil and human rights to Irish Catholics, and for all practical purposes outlawed the Catholic religion in Ireland, the religion of more than 90% of the Irish population. Oh yeah, Ireland's Gaelic language was also outlawed. And then in 1801, the Act of Union, which went into effect January 1st, 1801, abolished the independent Irish Parliament and officially made Ireland part of the United Kingdom. As a result, all of Ireland was governed by the British Parliament in London during the Great Hunger of 1845 to 1852. And the years following until 1921, when the Anglo-Irish Treaty divided Ireland. Of the 32 counties that made up the island of Ireland, 26 eventually became the independent Republic of Ireland in the wake of 1948 legislation, while the 6 counties that made up the Northern Ireland remained part of the Protestant United Kingdom. If anyone says this wasn't a war against Catholics, they are sadly mistaken or liars. This is Reverse Deception Radio, and I'm your host, Gregory Carpenter, on the Veritas Radio Network. And this is the Irish Genocide and the Great Hunger.
Ahoy, ahoy, y'all know, ahoy, ahoy, y'all. Skrøyen høy, snorøy, skrøyen høy, av vannar og hjun, stusem og græ.
Phytophthora infestations, the fungus that invades the potato plant and causes its rapid decay, struck for the first time in the eastern United States in the summer of 1843. The invisible fungus spores were transported to Belgium in a cargo of an apparently healthy potato. And in the summer of 1845, the fungus revived and reproduced, devastating the potato crop in Flanders, Normandy, Holland, and southern England. By 1845, the blight was recorded at the Dublin Botanical Gardens, and a week later, a total failure of the crop was reported in County Fermanagh. By October, there was panic in the west of Ireland as the blight destroyed healthy potatoes harvested in August. In 1845, the blight had been localized and variegated, but from early reports in 1846, it was obvious that blight had affected the potato crop throughout Ireland. While it had been difficult to obtain an accurate estimate of the damage caused by the blight in 1845, as its appearance was spread over a number of months, in 1846, the destruction of the potato crop was as rapid as it was comprehensive. The nutritionist potato had been the mainstay of the agricultural laborers in the cotter class, laborers that live in cottages, and dominated the diets of at least two-thirds of the population. No other country in Europe depended upon the potato as extensively as Ireland. When the blight hit the first year, it was a disaster for those who depended upon the potato. When the blight returned in the following years, it meant death for many who were already living precariously at subsistence level, and emigration for those who had the resources to flee disease, death, and poverty. It was a famine, yes, and it was a disaster of major proportions, even allowing for statistical uncertainty as to its estimated effect on mortality. Yet the famine occurred in a country that, despite concurrent economic problems, was at the center of a still-growing empire and an integral part of the acknowledged workshop of the world. There's no doubt that despite a short-term cyclical depression, the resources of the United Kingdom could have either completely or largely mitigated the consequences of consecutive years of potato blight in Ireland without much effort. Within Ireland itself, there were substantial resources of food that, had the political will existed, could have been diverted, even as a short-term measure to feed the starving people. The policy of closing ports during periods of shortages in order to keep homegrown food for domestic consumption had, on previous occasions, proved to be very effective in staving off famine within Ireland. During the crisis of 1782-84, an embargo was placed on the export of foodstuff from the country. The outcome of this humanitarian and very imaginative policy was very successful. The years 1782-84 are barely remembered as years of distress. By refusing to allow a similar policy to be adopted in 46 and 47, the British government ensured that what had become known as Black 47 was indelibly associated with suffering, famine, morbidity, mortality, emigration, and to a great extent, misrule, human abuse, human rights violations, and all-out genocide.
There were three genocides in Ireland. There was one under Elizabeth I, in which half the population was wiped out, and that was the illegitimate daughter of Henry VIII.
Correct.
A second one under Cromwell, to hell or Connaught. And then the one of 1845, 1850,
Oliver Cromwell, the Calvinist, who took over.
Correct. Yes. And then the last one was the so-called potato famine.
You see, in some locations, over 30% of the population had perished. A population approaching 9 million dramatically decreased. But was it all due to a fungus? Was it all due to potatoes? Or was there something more sinister at foot. The 1841 census showed that there were over 8 million people living in the four provinces of Connacht, Leinster, Munster, and Ulster. Only 40 years later, at the 1881 census, the figure had fallen by over 3 million to a little over 5 million people. 37% fewer people. The number continued to fall, and by 1926, 4.25 million people lived there. Ireland, like many other locations around the globe, was no stranger to natural disasters. The Great Frost of 1740-1741, Bliain an Eich, or the Year of Slaughter, was a period of unusually cold weather that lasted from December 1739 to September 1741. It was an event that affected the whole of Europe, though seemed to have its worst effects in Ireland and Northern England and Scotland. Deep frosts only occurred during the winter months, but there was little real respite afterwards, as the spring and summer weather was unusually cold and dry, leading to the death of livestock and the failure of crops. Therefore, the inability to prepare for a second unusually cold winter. Records are still scant, the population size only an estimate, but estimations were that up to 38% of the population had died.
Oh.
Ireland had always had a reasonable amount of immigration, especially to the U.S. and England, and in particular about 1.5 million leaving in the 30-year period from 1815 to 1845. In the latter half of the 1840s, a steady but narrow stream was increased to a flood. The reason, of course, starvation. And it wasn't only to the U.S. and to England that they fled. No, it went all over the world. About 70 million people today can claim Irish ancestry and trace it back to that period.
Cold blows the wind upon my true love. Soft falls the gentle rain.
The potatoes grown in Ireland at the time and eaten by the poor were almost exclusively a variety called the Irish lumper. And it was particularly susceptible to potato blight, though the other varieties grown at the time were not really any more resistant. In a peculiar manner, despite the famine and the failure of the main crop that should have provided a staple diet for over one-third of the population, mostly the poorest, Ireland did successfully produce a good crop of grain in 1847. This grain was owned in the main by absent landlords. It was exported for cash while many of Ireland's own people were starving. Despite the over-resilience on potatoes, grain is unaffected by the potato blight fungus. Retaining the grain, or a portion of it, would have averted the worst effects of the famine if they had only fed the people. In many cases, the poor were often reduced to looking through the ravaged potato fields for any hole or part of a potato that has escaped the disease. In 1847, the potato crop was somewhat better. Although again, blight struck in 1848 and 1849, when disease compounded the effects of starvation. Cholera, in particular, struck the weakened people, killing more than had died from starvation itself. And in 1850, the crop improved and potato blight never appeared on the same scale again. Potato blight is still around today, though fungicides first developed in the 1880s, and resistant varieties mean it doesn't threaten crops as it once did. The death toll in Ireland is considered the greatest disaster of the 19th century. Sure, the potato blight affected the whole of Europe, but nowhere else in the world did it hit as hard as Ireland. As a matter of fact, there was no famine anywhere else. The British consumed many potatoes, and their crop had failed, but they couldn't let the heart of the empire fall. They could not let the rest of the world see them weak. So soldiers were sent to enforce the exports.
But some years ago, 1983, in the course of doing my grandfather's biography, what, sad to say, was in the British Army, in the public record office of the British government, of the British state, in Kew Garden, London, in their national archives, I found out that the regiment that he served in, when he was 7, 8, 9, and 10 years of age in County Tipperary, it was starving South County Galway. It had been sent in to Ireland, to South County Galway, to remove all the food from South County Galway to the port of Galway for export. There was an abundant food of all kinds in Ireland. Wheat, oats, barley, rye, poultry, beef, mutton, the whole range, vegetable, everything. It was abundant in its food. So I found out that...
So there was no shortage of food from natural disaster, some kind of lack of rainfall or economic conditions.
One of 15 crops failed. The potato crop failed. It failed throughout Europe. But there was no famine anywhere. But when Britain sent in 75 regiments
to and now why did they send in 75 regiments?
Because their potato crop failed.
The historical record doesn't lie, folks. When the British potato crop failed, they had to do something, and they had to ensure that they would not starve themselves. Having deemed the Irish as subhuman for several centuries, the British had nothing compelling them to be nice to the Irish when hard times befell them. They put up the blockade, they sent the soldiers, and in a British regiment at that time, there was about 1,000 soldiers. Ergo, British took between 75,000 and 100,000 soldiers and stationed them all over Ireland to ensure that the food would not stop being exported. England herself needed the food. They were going through the Industrial Revolution. Haven't you heard? What are you, a Luddite? Everything was being mechanicalized. Machinery was popping up. Progress was going on. As England became more industrialized, they had less farms and less ability to provide for their own needs. Therefore, it had to be imported.
English people were heavily dependent. The London Times of August 25th, 1845 said that the average Englishman's day consisted of two meals of potatoes. So they were heavily dependent upon potatoes.
So potato was a staple in the diet of both the Anglo-British as yeah. well as the Irish, yeah. Celtic, or whatever other people.
But the British or English were living in urban areas, mostly in cities. So they survived by food that was brought in from elsewhere. While in Ireland, they lived on land and there was abundant food of all kinds. So to say the potato crop failed, therefore the people died, would be like saying in Chicago, pizza disappeared, so we all starved to death.
England had lost one of her most precious possessions, these United States, and issues around the globe limited England's ability to continually import. The British economy was upside down. They imported much more raw material and exported not as much.
For no more I'll go waltzing, Matilda, all around the green bush far and near. For to hump tent and pace, a man needs both legs. No more waltzing, Matilda. They collected the wounded, the crippled, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The armless, the legless, the blind, the insane.
Born into a wealthy, powerful, Anglo-Irish Protestant landowning family, he entered the House of Commons in 1875. He was a land reform agitator and became leader of the Home Rule League in 1880, insisting on operating independently of the Liberals and winning great influence by his balancing of constitutional, radical, and economic issues, and by his skillful use of parliamentary procedure. And it was in September 1880 that Parnell gave a speech in Ennis, County Clare, to a crowd of Land League members. He asked the crowd, "What do you do with a tenant who bids for a farm from which his neighbor has been evicted?" The crowd responded, "Kill him, shoot him." Parnell replied, "I wish to point out to you a very much better way, a more Christian and charitable way, which will give the lost man an opportunity of repenting. When a man takes a farm from which another has been evicted, you must shun him on the roadside when you meet him. You must shun him in the streets of the town. You must shun him in the shop. You must shun him on the fair green and in the marketplace, and even in the place of worship, by leaving him alone, by putting him in moral Coventry, by isolating him from the rest of the country as if he were a leper of old. You must show him your detestation of the crime he committed." Who was he in opposition to? A man who was a retired army officer, who worked as a land agent for Lord Erne, John Crichton, 3rd Earl of Erne, a landowner in the Lomask area of County Mayo. You see, in 1880, as part of its campaign for the three Fs, fair rent, fixity of tenure, and free sale, and specifically in resistance to proposed evictions on the estate, local activists of the Land Irish League encouraged his employees, including the seasonal workers required to harvest the crops on Lord Ernst's estate to withdraw their labor and began a campaign of isolationism against him in the local community. This is exactly what Parnell had preached. The campaign included shops in nearby Villanrobe refusing to serve him, and the withdrawal of services. Some were threatened with violence to ensure compliance. Yes, it was a campaign which became La Cause Célèbre in the British press after he wrote a letter to the Times. Newspapers sent correspondents to the west of Ireland to highlight what they viewed as the victimization of a servant of a peer of the realm by Irish nationalists. 50 Orangemen from County Cavan and County Monaghan traveled to Lord Erne's estates to harvest the crops, while a regiment of the 19th Royal Hussars and more than 1,000 men of the Royal Irish Constabulary were deployed to protect the harvesters. The episode was estimated to have cost the British government and others at least £10,000 to harvest only 500 pounds worth of crop. He left Ireland 1 December 1880 and in 1886 became a land agent for Hugh Adair's Flixton estate in Suffolk. He died at the age of 65 in June of 1897 in his home in Flixton after an illness earlier that year. But nary there be a person who speaks the English language who does not know of Captain Charles Cunningham Boycott, the English land agent whose ostracism by his local community in Ireland gave the English language the verb to boycott. Yes, he had served in the British Army's 39th Foot, which left him in Ireland, and because of his position, he was able to secure work as a land agent and become the nemesis of many of Ireland's poorest. So how did it happen? How did this become such a political mess with the British bent on genocide? Was it just political differences, or did it run much deeper than that? History vets out, it was all about religion. Well, almost all about religion, but it was definitely all about religion. In order to understand the situation in the 1840s in Ireland, you first have to examine the events that led up to this. British-Irish relations first began in the 12th century when British citizens began traveling to the Emerald Isles. Prior to that point, Ireland was ruled by a wide range of small kingdoms. That left the country relatively divided. When Henry II gained control of the throne in England, there was much interest in expanding into their neighbors. While his traveling to Ireland was mostly political, it was in part religious as well, and probably most religious. You see, folks, there was a guy, Nicholas Breakspear. You may know him as Pope Adrian IV, also Hadrian IV, the only English pope. He implored Henry II to invade Ireland in order to spread Christian ideals, specifically the teachings of the Catholic Church. So in order to motivate Henry II, the Pope gave him the title Lord of Ireland prior to Henry II's domination of the island. In doing so, the Pope saw Ireland as a state under British rule rather than one with its own people and culture. It wasn't until the 1300s that the Irish gained back their country after a series of conquests. When Henry VIII separated from the Catholic Church and created the Church of England in the mid-1500s, the country had once converted the Irish natives to Catholicism. Well, now, Henry VIII attempted to make them all Protestant. This sudden shift wasn't welcomed by the powerful Irish families, nor was it welcomed by the lesser. That actually led to a rebellion in 1534, led by Thomas, Lord Offaly. Unfortunately, the revolt failed, and power went back right into the hands of the British. Henry VIII was granted the title King of Ireland by the Irish Parliament in 1541. With this new power, Henry VIII imposed a reformation on the people of Ireland. This included procedures to take land from the Irish and give it to the new British settlers in an attempt to drive the Irish out of their own country. The unrest caused by these new policies resulted in the Nine Years' War at the turn of the 17th century, led by Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyne. The Irish eventually lost to Elizabeth I's army in 1603. Religion was once again the issue when James II became King of England in 1685. Because he was Catholic, he did not gain favor with the Protestant community in Ireland, and was eventually succeeded by the Protestant William of Orange. With William's gain of the throne, multiple penal laws were put into place, which took rights away from the Catholics. These laws significantly decreased the Catholics' ability to own their own property, gain a good education, and protect themselves with weapons. This obviously caused unrest within the Catholic community, and led by Henry Grattan, and inspired by the French and Americans' quest for independence, the newly formed United Irishmen rebelled against the British government. However, the revolt failed. As a result, the Irish Parliament was disbanded, and control went into the hands of the Protestant Irish, who were members of the British Parliament. By the early 1800s, a Catholic association had formed in an attempt to better represent the Catholic community in Ireland. As part of leader Daniel O'Connell's work towards Catholic emancipation, a compromise seemed necessary. Therefore, a distinction was made for the first time between Northern Ireland, or Ulster, and what is now the Republic of Ireland. At the same time, the Fenians, an Irish Republican Brotherhood, was formed to try and recover land that had been taken by the British. And this led to the Declaration of the Land Act. It was poorly executed, and thus the Catholic Republicans were even more eager to separate themselves from the Protestant British than ever before. With the formation of a Parliament lobby group for Irish independence in 1870, the Home Rule League was created in order to try to gain this separation. However, Home Rule was opposed by lobbyists in Northern Ireland who felt that Irish economic success was due in large part to Ireland's ties with England. This disagreement resulted in the formation of a range of Republican groups, including Sinn Féin and the Irish Republican Brotherhood, as well as small armies such as the Protestant Ulster Volunteer Force and the Nationalist Irish Volunteers. The effects of these groups were felt at the Easter Rising, when in 1916 members of the IRB formed an attack against the British government, who they felt would be preoccupied by the events of World War I. The attack in Dublin failed, however, with the execution of certain members of the IRB, Republicans gained sympathy and favor within Ireland. With its additional support, the British Volunteers soon became the Irish Republican Army, led in part by Michael Collins. Using guerrilla tactics, the IRA was able to begin the Irish War of Independence. Worried by the violence that might result from this rebellion, the British officials soon put in place curfews for Irish citizens, as well as placing more troops on Irish soil. from Gregory Carpenter, his father, Burton Carpenter, his mother, Jessie Marie Wild, her father, Jesse John Wild, his father, James Henry Wild, his father, Jesse Wild, Lancashire, England, and his father, the same. Jesse Wild's wife, Margaret McLean, Kilkenny, Ireland. Great-great-great-grandfather James Quinlan, Cork, Ireland. His wife, Joanna Grace Doyle, Cork, Ireland. Great-great-great-grandfather Patrick Ahern, Kilkenny, Ireland. His wife, Mary Ann Conley, Limerick, Ireland. All of my great-great-great-grandparents from this part of my family arrived here between 1845 and 1850.
Some rover. and my days are numbered. So come all ye young men and lay me down.
From Oliver Cromwell,
so
I read
come all ye young men
to his mother Elizabeth Stewart.
And lay me down.
William Stewart, his father. Sir Thomas Stewart, son of William Stewart, to his daughter, Sarah Stewart, to John Abbott the First, to his son, Reuben Abbott, to his daughter, Margaret Abbott, to her son, Captain Reuben Libby, to his son, Jeremiah Libby, to his daughter, Sarah Frances Libby, to her son, Reuben Davis, to his daughter, Grace Davis, to her son, Charles Edward Hasty, to his daughter, Joan Carpenter, to me, Gregory Carpenter, my first cousin, 11 times removed, Oliver Cromwell. This is his impact on the population of Ireland.
Historical evidence of documented archival evidence,
yes,
of both proof of a British famine from London, newspapers.
No, it was a fear of a British famine.
Okay, fear of famine, as well as the deployment of, which would have been in military records,
correct,
of these 75 regiments.
Correct.
Thought mass graves were only for Saddam Hussein, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, and members of that ilk. Listen to what was found in Ireland. Listen and learn about the British mass graves for the murdered Irish.
But after Mary and I put up a memorial at one that was brought to our attention in North County Galway, near Ballymoe, so many people came to us with knowledge of other mass graves that had been in their family, or that they had known about ever since 1845, 1850, that we've concluded that there are some 3,000 or so mass graves in Ireland perpetrated, filled with people murdered in those years.
We're not going to have the opportunity to get to the story of Oliver Cromwell and his despicable actions in this show. So I think we're going to take this to a second show. And please ponder the truth, my friends. Take the time to reflect upon the information that we've shared today. Go back and challenge your children's history teacher. Bring it to their attention. Was there a famine? Yes, there was a famine. was the potato crop destroyed in 1846. Yes, it was destroyed in 1846. But 75% of all of the grains and crops from Ireland were exported off the island. And if people attempted to stop the authorities from removing it, they were killed. Do you think that that could happen today? Do you think there's a possibility with centralized control of the food production? So few farms create so much food, and it's happening more and more every day. Don't lie to yourself. Be a realist. If there's one government that is supposed to be upstanding and the standard for all the modern world to reflect, and they can do this, think what all of those other, not quite as moral as governments, could do to you and to me and to everyone else. No, there is no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. There's no dancing in joy. Many believe that more Irish were starved to death during the famine and subsequent military occupation of Ireland than were Jews killed in World War II by Hitler. The accepted number of Irish that died exceeds the 6 million, and most Jewish scholars who calculate the number of dead at the hands of the Nazis is actually only 5.1 million. We could debate the numbers, but isn't it irrelevant? Genocide is genocide. It doesn't matter what flag it flies under, what face it wears, or in the back of what courtroom money is handed around. Know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Well, next episode, you will learn the truth about Oliver Cromwell and the Catholic Confederacy on Reverse Deception Radio.
This is Reverse Deception Radio on the Veritas Radio Network, Crusade Channel. King Size Truth,
Erin Goprah,
from Radio Size Speakers.
Don't hack like my son.
And don't hack like my dad.